Audio of Stranger at the Pentagon by Frank E. Strangers, Ph.D. Introduction. It was while I was attending seminary school that I first heard about what were then being called flying saucers, and while others around me might have laughed, I felt I had an open mind and sincerely wanted to learn the truth. What I found was that astute men of authority had gone on record as being among those in the world that have admitted the presence and reality of the unidentified flying objects. Men such as Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, who said flying saucers are real, too many good men have seen them, men that do not have hallucinations. Henry J. Taylor asserts that during his research to determine whether flying saucers actually do exist, and if so, where they have come from, I was actually stumped by the conflicting reports of eyewitnesses, until I found there are two mysteries in our skies instead of one. One mystery involves our development of secret weapons, but the other is not revealed by an earthly interpretation. Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowding, Command-in-Chief of the Royal Air Force, stated, "I am convinced that these objects do exist. They are not manufactured by any nation of this earth." The United States Air Force to this date has denied the very existence of flying saucers. Therefore, the term unidentified flying objects has been introduced and carried through. They evidently are not too certain as to the whys and wherefores, or do they? The late Major Donald Kehoe, the renowned director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, made a thorough investigation of this subject. Major Kehoe, as a result of his investigation, offered much information. He stated that flying discs actually change colors in the sky, and it has been proven. To affirm this, he states, during daytime periods, scores of metallic-looking discs have been seen to change color during maneuvers. One typical report, in 1950, described an encounter near Lewisburg, West Virginia. Two round, silvery discs had approached the city, then swung into a tight, fast circle. As the maneuvers began, both turned orange-red. When they straightened, reducing speed, the orange quickly faded and the discs resumed their normal silvery color. Also, be informed of the following event involving Captain Robert Addix, a stocky ex-Navy pilot with 10 years' service with the TWA. I refer to the dramatic incident near South Bend, Indiana. On the night of April 27, 1950 at 8:25 p.m., with Captain Addix in the left-hand seat of a TWA DC-3, over on the right, sat Robert F. Manning, also a four-stripe captain, who was acting as first officer on this flight to Chicago. The DC-3, Flight 117, was cruising at 20,000 feet when a strange, red light below and behind the airliner suddenly caught Manning's eye. Puzzled, Manning watched it close in, the light steadily growing in size. It was now an orange-red color, eke a blob of hot metal sweeping through the night sky. Craning his neck, Manning looked down on a spherical shape which glowed brightly on top, its lower half in shadow. To Addix it looked like a huge red wheel rolling down a road. He banked toward it. But the discs instantly slid away, keeping the same distance. Again he tried, with the same results. Calling the hostess, Gloria Henshaw, Addix told her to alert the passengers, to make sure he had plenty of witnesses. A report on the type of men the pilots were from the TWA offices described them both as quiet, conservative, serious, careful. Nobody in TWA questioned that Addix and Manning had seen exactly what they had said. Gloria Henshaw had seen the disc from the cabin and the pilot's cockpit. She told Major Kehoe, "It looked like a big red wheel rolling along." She also made the statement that on top it looked like it was on fire. Major Kehoe interviewed all 11 passengers by long-distance calls, the first one being S.N. Miller, manager of a jewelry company in St. Paul. He had watched the saucer for several minutes. He accounted for it, saying, "The thing was the color of a neon sign, not just a big red disc. I used to laugh at saucer stories, but not anymore." Major Kehoe said that among other passengers who confirmed the sighting were C.H. Jenkins and D.C. Bland, engineers with the Boeing Aircraft Co., and E.J. Fitzgerald, VP of a metal equipment corporation in Chicago. Later, several officials of the International Harvester Company also admitted they had seen the glowing disc as it paced the plain. More reports of their fiery red appearance come from Greenville, S.C., where on the night of May 13, 1952, astronomers had seen four saucers flying, glowing a reddish-yellow, amber. On June 19, 1952, intelligence reports came from Goose Bay Air Force Base that a glowing red disc approached the field at night. There is absolutely no question whatever concerning the actual existence of these flying objects. There is certainly something in the skies above us, and someone is responsible for them being there. It has been stated time and again that these objects must be under intelligent control. One of the greatest thorns in the flesh to many Bible scholars, ministers, etc., is the statement of life on other planets. It seems very strange that we who are finite beings continually attempt to force God into the test tube of our 2x4 human understanding and reasoning. We must never lose sight of the one prime fact that God is the Creator while we are His creation. During the past few years, I have met men and women from all walks of life. Many of these people are continually looking for truth, seeking for the very truths that will cause a better way of life to come up over the far horizon. Nevertheless, if we can but place our trust in God, and lay hold on the blessings and provisions that are made for us through the Lord Jesus Christ, we might make the discovery that these great revelations are with the grasp of every honest believer. In the following pages, as you carefully study the questions and answers supplied me by this friend from outer space, you will find that, unlike many other contact stories, Val does not minimize the fact that Jesus Christ is the first and the last, the Alpha and the Omega, and the beginning and the end. That is one great reason why I believe that Val has spoken the truth and nothing but the truth concerning his mission to this wayward planet. Often, events transpire that cause one to wonder if these certain events really happened or are figments of the imagination. Then, one begins to ponder the facts that have caused an experience to really live. Writing this book has presented quite a challenge. The following is an account as told to me and which involved the Earth visits of one, Valiant Thor, from another planet. The story itself is quite unique. May have read of this unusual visit at the Pentagon and have likewise claimed to have first-hand information that this event did in fact take place. At the same time, there are those who choose to accept this account as something that could not possibly have taken place because of the intense security at the Pentagon. Then again, there are those who would retort that the Pentagon is the only place this could have happened. It will be most interesting to continue watching this account develop over the coming years. Although these incidents took place beginning in 1957, they have reportedly been witnessed by many others in many parts of the world. Some of these witnesses have related the incidents, while others have chosen to remain silent because of the fear of ridicule. They would never think of openly repeating their own experiences, with one claiming to be from another world. Valiant addressed a special group of representatives at the United Nations in a closed session. The ramifications of such a gathering forced the exclusion of the media from this meeting. He appeared of his own free will. The delegates were stunned, some to the point of anger, some to the point of fear. He is on a special mission to this third planet from there. Sun and is presently working with many hundreds of his crew in conjunction with many on this planet. The following pages will reveal much, at least to those who are capable of discerning knowledge, wisdom, and above all, understanding. As you read through the pages, you will find yourself caught up in the story itself. Some of you will read with great delight and desire. Others will read with an eye to ridicule. However, as you read, you must certainly agree that during the past 60 years, we have come a very long way in the related fields of science and technology. As you continue to read, please remember that any decision you choose is entirely up to you. Strive to maintain an open mind. The things that we think we know, we do not know at all, while the things we do not know are oftentimes revealed to us surrounded by pure golden light, thus enlarging our capability to believe. This might well be the year that UFOs will prove once and for all that we are not alone in this expanding universe, and that we, members of the human family, might conceivably learn that our family ties are not restricted to this planet Earth. Remember, you are never alone. To those who have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, I say God bless you. To all others, God help you. Dr. Frankie. Strangers. Headline, Chapter 1, The Landing. Hello, Frank, how are you? That greeting will forever be etched in my memory. It always brings me back to that cold day in December, 1959, a day which changed my life forever and one which I will recall as if it were yesterday for the rest of my life. That day began a journey which continues and one which endures even to this writing. The story began centuries ago with the first reconnaissance exploration voyage which confirmed that there indeed was life on this third planet from the sun. There had been occasions which presented a dilemma to both the observed as well as the observer. These included several pilots being beamed into the ship in order to save their lives. This was a far cry from the first incidents of men throwing rocks in an attempt to repel the ship. It was during 1945 that the Earth was surrounded by 100 ships in order to protect the fragile atmosphere which surrounds it. A chain atomic reaction could easily have resulted because of the separation of the elements of the air. Earth could have been destroyed, thus creating many problems, a ripple effect so to speak, throughout the universe. After reporting the observations of various voyages, several recommendations were made. The first was that an aerial display be performed in order to provide evidence of the physical existence of life, as it is known here, on other planets in the solar system. This was accomplished during the Truman administration over the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. Newspapers reported the occurrence complete with details of the chase. What they didn't report was that the UFOs were not visible below the planes which had been sent up. They were only visible to those on the ground. The second recommendation was for physical contact with world leaders, beginning with the United States. Headline, The First Meeting. March 16, 1957, in Alexandria, Virginia, one of the finest leaders of the planet Venus, operating under the direction of the Central Control and who had been chosen to make the contact as well as direct the project, landed his craft and was met by two police officers, weapons drawn. A thought transference quickly convinced them that he meant no harm and he was ushered into the back seat of their patrol car. After crossing over into Washington, D.C., they were met by the Secretary of Defense along with six of his staff members. Soon police from every conceivable district and agency had joined in, all trying to claim their right to escort him to President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Through his own version of the power of positive thinking, he was able to dismiss them all and soon passed through the security posts followed by an Air Force captain. Meanwhile, his presence in the area had thrown everyone into a dilemma. The introduction he held from the High Council worried them because, though not written in any earthly language, their minds were given power to properly translate the inscribed message. Captain Gould, not his real name, asked him to remain and after downing two plain bourbons muttered, "My God, why couldn't this have happened on my day off?" Suddenly the door opened and six armed guards led Val to what appeared to be an elevator. It went rapidly to the bottommost level. Maximum security was in place. After transferring to an underground train, they sped toward the White House. Six officials, six armed guards and three Secret Service men escorted him into the office of President Eisenhower. From behind the desk the president rose while the Secret Service men remained nervous and uneasy. As he extended his hand to shake that of the president, the Secret Service men drew their revolvers and pointed them at Val. Following the nod of the president, they reluctantly lowered their guns. Standing in front of his desk, the president said, "Of course, you know we have suspended all rules of protocol. I have a good feeling toward you." "Please, sir, what is your name?" He replied, "Valiant." "And where do you come from?" "I come from the planet your Bible calls the morning and the evening star." "Venus?" "Yes, sir." "Can you prove this?" he asked. "What do you constitute as proof?" He quickly retorted, "I don't know." "Will you come with me to my ship?" he answered with a quizzical look and said, "My friend, I cannot come and go as I please. There are others to be considered." There are committees to be consulted and security measures to be adhered to. Please spend some time with us here, let's get better acquainted, learn more about one another, and perhaps soon, real soon, well, we shall see. Headline, Richard Nixon. At that moment, another gentleman rushed into the room. It turned out to be Vice President Richard Nixon. He appeared to Val to be very sharp, quick-witted, with fixed eyes and an amazing aptitude toward speed and proficiency. "My name is Valiant," he said as the Vice President thrust his hand without hesitation. "You have certainly caused a stir, for an out-of-towner." The Vice President smiled as he continued, "Of course, we are not totally convinced of anything just yet. But suffice it to say we are checking and double-checking everything you say and do." When Sergeant Young from Alexandria radioed in and stated that you had just landed in a flying saucer, we thought. He continued, Sergeant Young had flipped. "Say, were you in on that UFO flap over Washington? You certainly had us all in a dither, if you were." After assuring them that this planet had been under close scrutiny for hundreds of years before the 1945 bomb blast and with his special letter still in the slightly quivering hand of the president, he was requested to follow the Secret Service back the way they had come, to the Pentagon and into a beautifully furnished apartment where he would spend the next 3 years. Fortunately, he was prepared for such a lengthy visit and kept in constant communication with the starship. There were many occasions during which he teleported himself in and out of those quarters, often exercising transimagery to cause the security guards to visualize his face on a non-existent ID badge. Headline. Photos taken. Soon after his arrival, together with three members of his crew, he joined a convention in the backyard of the home of Mr. Howard Menger in High Bridge, New Jersey. The month was April, 1957. A certain group of individuals who were interested in UFOs were meeting that day. Val and his crew members, Don, Jill and Tanya, had changed into the same type of clothing worn by their Earth friends. The meeting was very interesting and these people were on the right track. He was dismayed to learn the undignified manner in which these people were treated by the press. Nevertheless, these people were pursuing their beliefs and this was good. A curious young photographer, August C. Roberts, snapped several pictures, thinking he was doing so without Val's knowledge. The photographer seemed to be greatly troubled when he attempted to talk to him. Yet, it was those very photographs which were to bring me together with this unusual man on that cold December day. Holding the message from the High Council in his hand, the president stated that Val's offer to help the human family would upset the economy of the United States and could plunge her into the abyss of chaos. In brief, he politely told Val that the people of this planet were not ready to cope with such conditions as would come into existence if the recommendations of this unearthly visitor were put into action. Nevertheless, he was invited to assist a number of scientists who were out working on medical projects directly associated with the space sciences. His allotted time to acquaint the leaders of the United States with his suggestions was limited to 3 years. During this time, he refused to advise them regarding a certain bomb in the sky which we now know as the Star Wars system. Headline, Miracle Garment. In his apartment, he was able to maintain communications with his ship and was kept informed of the growing world tensions. His uniform underwent rigid tests at that time. By today's standards, they would now be obsolete. They attempted to penetrate the material with a diamond drill bit, but it snapped under pressure. Acid rolled off the uniform and burned a hole in the floor. They fired a high-velocity rifle at the uniform but it failed to pierce it. The report to the president read, physical appearance soft silver and gold lustrous fabric unknown weight 6 ounces, total, including boots cut close-fitting like a tunic, no cuffs, pockets, buttons, zippers, clips or hooks. Headline, tests indestructible. Finally, a bright-eyed colonel escorted him to a place where the final test would be performed. Val looked at the laser instrument amusingly. Upon command, the laser rained a fine line of intense light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. The colonel began his discourse that this device contained a crystal synthetic ruby in which atoms, when stimulated by focused light waves, amplify and concentrate these waves, then emit the beam. As the colonel continued to speak, his smile gave way to utter dismay, the ray being totally ineffective against the garment. He babbled on. Long after the laser has been turned off, he reiterated how powerful the US has become since the splitting of the atom. He gave Van a lesson in atomic fusion. He went on to state that when a chain reaction of nuclear fission is set off by a neutron bombardment in the atoms or a charge of plutonium or uranium isotope with an atomic weight of 235, U-235, an immense quantity of energy is suddenly released. The good colonel finally talked himself out and Val was conducted back to his quarters, along with his uniform. 1959 was fast drawing to a close. Chiefs of state were in a constant turmoil and confusion was the rule of the day. Indecision caused delay after delay. Economists and industrial giants conferred with politicians and the military heads daily. The government leaders could not reconcile Val's being in a position to force their hand if he so desired. Several scientists attempted to learn the secrets of interstellar travel, without success. Christmas week was now upon us. I had been busily presenting a series of scientific lectures and speaking at a number of churches in Washington, D.C. earlier that month. I had returned from Cuba where I met personally with Fidel Castro. Unbeknownst to me, Val, working with Nancy Warren, she was one of only a few since his arrival at the Pentagon in whom he was able to discern an honest and open heart and who loved Almighty God, her country and her fellow man, formulated a plan whereby I would be contacted. Headline: Inside the Pentagon. Many Earth people live one life openly while in their hearts and minds, they live quite another. Double-mindedness seemed to be a way of life in the Pentagon building that served as the busy nerve center of our nation. Val once remarked to me that he had never witnessed in one central location such concentrated confusion. Nancy attended the lecture service which I conducted at the National Evangelistic Center, pastored by Dr. John Mears, in Washington, D.C. Following the conclusion of my talk, she approached the platform and asked to speak to me. Strangely enough, the photographer in New Jersey had given Val's photographs to me and I had been displaying them at my lectures ever since. I had no personal knowledge of them, other than what I had been told by the photographer. When she was unable to grab my attention while I was signing copies of my book Sorcerer, she showed her Pentagon ID and that got my attention quickly to say the least. We borrowed the pastor's study and she asked me if I would like to meet the man in the photographs personally. Of course, I answered her with a resounding yes. She then asked if I could follow instructions to the letter, to which I replied that I could, and she told me to meet her at the curb in front of my hotel at 8 a.m. the next morning. Nancy arrived precisely on time and thus began the journey which at times would seem unreal, but which later would prove beyond doubt that there is truly life in God's universe. Those of you familiar with the Pentagon know that the normal traffic flow approaching it is to the right. We drove to the left. I knew then that something strange was going on. 37 We had to stand in line to pass by a security guard. First one, then the second, visualized an identification badge on my lapel. This utterly amazed me and I felt that at any minute, I would be picked up, handcuffed and thrown into some jail somewhere. This of course was only my imagination and anticipation of what was about to take place. Nancy left me standing in front of a door which contained no markings. As the door opened, I walked in and stood on the threshold. My stocky form shifted from one foot to the other as I cleared my throat. The three men in the room were completely unaware of my presence and ignored me. I was puzzled to say the least. Later, I would find out that Val had clouded their minds and rendered them oblivious to the entire session. They continued with their work. The stranger appears being a minister of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, as well as a student of the Bible for many years, coupled with my experience as a special investigator, I felt as though my senses were functioning properly and that I knew exactly what I was about to do. I was on my guard for fakes and frauds. In walked a man, about 6 feet tall, perhaps 185 pounds, brown wavy hair, brown eyes, His complexion appeared normal and slightly tanned. As I approached him and he looked at me, it was as though he looked straight through me. With a warm smile and extending his hand, he greeted me by name. "Hello, Frank. How are you?" His genuineness astonished me, but quickly I understood. As I gripped his hand, I was somewhat surprised to feel the soft texture of his skin, like that of a baby but with the strength of a man that silently testified to his power and intensity. His voice was very strong and mellow. It was filled with purpose and character. I again looked around the room to see whether the other men would say or do anything. They were still working as if I weren't there. I noticed that he was wearing the same type of clothing as I. When I asked if he possessed any other clothing, he said that he had given several officials a garment so that they could run tests on it. He then proceeded to a closet and produced a one-piece suit that glittered as the sun which streamed in through the window hit the fabric. I thought that it looked like liquid sunshine. I asked him about the material from which it was made. He answered, "It is made of material not of this earth." The general appearance of the suit was all one piece, even down to the boots. It contained no buttons, zippers or snaps. I asked him how it held together. He demonstrated by holding the front together and passing his hand over it as if to smooth it out. I could not even locate the opening. It was held together by an invisible force. To help mankind, he told me that his purpose in coming was to help mankind return to the Lord. He spoke in positive terms, always with a smile on his face. He said that man was further away from God than ever before, but there was still a good chance if man looks in the right place. He told me he had been here. Of fingerprints intrigued me as I had been involved as a private investigator for quite some time, even working at times on loan to some of the government agencies. I had learned the science of fingerprints, with the impression of the lines and whorls on the inner surface of the last joint of each finger on the human hand. He told me that all earth people were thusly marked since the fall of Adam in the Garden of Eden, during the very dawn of civilization as we know it today. He began to prepare me for the road which lay ahead. It would not be an easy one. There would be adversities, organized attempts to both discourage and discredit me, but the rewards have proved to outweigh these trials which continue even to this day. We discussed the merits of Jesus Christ, how he gave his life freely, so that men could enjoy the benefits of eternal life. I questioned him about a Bible on Venus and he assured me that a personal unbroken fellowship with the author did not necessitate the printing of a book. He found it amusing that many theologians attempt to discredit both Jesus Christ and the Bible. The very God many have said is dead continues to lavish them with all good things. Perhaps they will, in time, permit the spark of divine light to again illuminate their troubled hearts. In answer to my question of what he thought of Jesus Christ, he said, "I know that Jesus is the Alpha and Omega of yours and everyone else's faith. He today has assumed his rightful position as the ruler of the universe and is preparing a place and a time for all who are called by his name to ascend far above the clouds to where his power and authority shall never again be disputed." 41. I believe that Jesus Christ is the wonder of wonders and changes not. No, not forever and forever. As he spoke these words, my own heart burned within me and tears filled my eyes. He turned to the window and said, "Frank, it will not be long. Contend for the faith, and you will never miss the mark." I asked him if there is life on other planets. "Life on other planets," his reply was, "there is life on many other planets of which people on Earth know nothing. There are more solar systems for which man has not even given God credit. There are many beings that have never transgressed the perfect laws of God. Man does not possess the right to condemn the whole of God's creation because he himself has broken the perfect laws of God through disobedience." I asked him what he would do if the military prevented him from leaving on the appointed day. He simply stated, "Frank, do you remember one day after Jesus arose from the dead? He had gone in search of several of his followers. They closed themselves in a locked room and suddenly they saw Jesus standing in the very midst of them." He then smiled and looked at me as if to imply, "Need I say more?" As I turned to leave the room, He said simply, "Please keep your faith and leave the same way that you came in."